For people facing drug and alcohol addiction, going into rehab is often looked at as the most powerful treatment, the biggest source of hope. But really, what happens when people go into rehab, and are we getting good results from the programs that are out there? I'm Rob Ferret, filling in for Joy Cardine here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. My guest this hour looked into what goes on in addiction treatment, and she says we don't always get the care we need, even in the most expensive treatment facilities. Ann Fletcher is a health and medical writer. Her newest book is Inside Rehab, The Surprising Truth About Addiction Treatment and How to Get Help That Works. Welcome to the show.
Hi, it's good to be with you.
I'm glad you could join us. Before we get into what you found, can you talk about the scope, the variety of rehab and addiction treatment programs that are out there? It's a lot more than I would have thought.
Well, yeah. Well, first of all, you need to understand that there's 22 million people out there with substance use disorders. So that would be drug and alcohol problems that fall on a huge continuum. You know, everybody doesn't have a severe addiction. In fact, most people don't have the stereotypical kinds of severe addictions that you see on TV. But there's 22 million people, it's a lot, struggling with some kind of serious drug or alcohol problem, and only 1 out of 10 of them goes for help. So that's part of what drove me to really want to look into this. Why aren't more people getting help? There are about 13,000 drug and alcohol treatment programs across the country. And the truth is that most people who overcome serious drug and alcohol problems never set foot in the door of these programs. Most people who overcome drug and alcohol problems do it completely on their own. And the example I often give is George W. Bush. From everything we know, he, in his younger days, had a very serious drinking problem. As far as we know, he never set foot in AA or any kind of treatment program, and he overcame it probably with some help from religion. I had a whole list of celebrities who have done it on their own, and I know many, many people in my own personal life. So the vast majority of people overcome serious substance problems and addiction by completely on their own, by simply going to a self-help group. A self-help group, like AA, is not formal treatment. They are self-help groups. Or they do it by seeing an individual therapist who has some expertise with addictions. We don't know how many people overcome addictions that way, but many do. So it's really the minority who go for treatment, but many people who need treatment don't go. So again, that was part of what drove me to write this book, to understand why. So I traveled around the country and went to 15 different programs, very different kinds of programs, coast to coast. Everything from celebrity rehabs to programs that treat indigent people, outpatient programs, which provide about 80% of the treatment in this country. You know, we all think of people going to these overnight programs, residential programs, but most people go to programs where you're in the program for a couple hours a day and you're home at night. That's what most treatment in this country. And I visit some rural programs. And so anyway, I kind of saw it all. Some high-end famous 12-step programs. And they're listed in the book, the ones that I visited.
And a lot of what you did, a big part of your research, was talking to the clients, the people actually in these programs or people who come out of those programs.
Yes.
What kind of things did you learn from them?
Well, I interviewed more than 100 people and former clients, and I wanted people who had been through some kind of treatment program. And when I say rehab, most people think of that as the residential, you know, go-away overnight programs. I just use that term to describe all programs because rehab is rehabilitation from a drug or alcohol problem. So when I say rehab, I'm talking about residential and outpatient programs. I interviewed more than 100 people who had been in some kind of a rehab program. And I wanted people who had been recently with, for the most part, within the past 3 to 5 years, because programs change. And it wasn't fair for somebody, you know, who was bad-mouthing a program they went to 10 years ago, because some of the programs I visited changed in the course of my even writing the book. So I wanted a recent experience. But anyway, I interviewed more than 100 people who recently had been through rehab. Many of them were people I met at the programs that I visited who decided on their own to take part in the book, because when I was there, of course, everything was confidential. I was able to sit in on some of the groups at many of the programs, but that was, you know, I had to be a fly on the wall and then they could opt to take part in the book as a private, separate thing with me. So some of the people I was actually able to follow for years, because it took me almost 5 years to write the book. So about 100 people that way, some of their family members. Sadly, some people died in the course of writing the book from their drug and alcohol problems, and I was able to establish a relationship. There were just a few, fortunately, who that happened to, but was able to establish a relationship with family members. I interviewed and formed a relationship with more than 100 experts in the field and staffers who work at some of these programs, some of whom were willing to talk with me off the record about their experiences. Some of them are leading experts who study addiction treatment in the country, what works and what doesn't work. And then some of them were people working in the trenches. And then I also looked at the scientific literature, because there are people who study this in academics who study this, and many of them go into the field and actually observe and study this in a systematic scientific way.
A lot of us have the notion, I assume, that rehab is the best answer for somebody with addiction. You go either stay at this facility or go to an outpatient thing. You're going to deal with highly trained professionals who know what works, know what's effective. They're your best bet for getting better. What did you find? How far off the mark is that?
That about rehab being the most effective
mm-hmm.
way?
Yes.
To overcome an addiction? Well, what I really found is that different things work for different people. I found three major problems with the industry. The book is organized around the key issues that people face, consumers face, because you really need to think of yourself as a consumer when you're dealing with looking for treatment or help for a substance abuse problem or for a family member, because often the family member doesn't want treatment. Many times they're coerced or, that's for lack of a better term, you know, they don't recognize they need treatment. Although it's really a myth that everybody who has a problem is in denial. The research shows that people usually know they have a problem for many years before they seek treatment, but often they're hesitant and resistant to seek treatment for a variety of reasons. Sometimes I think it's because of the options that are out there, or that they've been through treatment before and they don't want to do the same thing again because it wasn't effective. I heard that from many people. But I identified, the book is organized around some of the key issues that people face as they're looking for treatment. So there's a whole chapter about the costs of rehab, which are huge. And I'm not just talking about financial costs, that's a major focus of that chapter, but also the emotional costs. What's it like to have a family member in and out of rehab over and over again, or a kid who has a substance abuse problem? I didn't want to just identify the problems, I also wanted to offer solutions. Okay, you don't have health insurance, or you do have health insurance, or here are your options if the only option available to you is being part of the public system, the public health system, and having public financing. So I explore, there's kind of a flow chart in the back of that chapter about if your situation is this, here's what you do. Basically looking at how do you get the best care for your situation. And I tell people's stories because this is my eighth book, and in all of my books, I always interview people, as I did in this book, and I believe that the best way to get across information is to learn from the people who have been there. To illustrate their stories, some of these people, and one of the saddest things, had been to rehab 10, 20 times and spent, they and their family members, tens, hundreds of thousands of dollars. But they had a lot of very important information to share about their experiences, and we could learn a lot from them, not just from the experts. So one chapter is about the cost. There is another chapter about people, this whole issue of who really needs to go to rehab. Since I said in the beginning most people recover about rehab, how do you figure out if you really need to be there or your loved one needs to be there? And what are the other options? Because people rarely tell you about those. How do you know what kind of treatment is effective? And we'll come back to that in a minute. What are the most effective strategies? What do you do if you or your loved one has a co-occurring psychological or psychiatric problem. A whole chapter on that, because more than half of people with a substance use disorder, which is the professional term for an addiction, more than half of people with a substance use disorder also have an accompanying mental health problem, like depression, anxiety, PTSD. So it's very important that those issues be addressed in order for the person to get well. So how do you find a problem that truly treats those problems?
We'll get into some of those issues one at a time as we go on through the hour. Talking to Ann Fletcher, author of the new book, Inside Rehab, The Surprising Truth About Addiction Treatment and How to Get Help That Works. Interested in hearing from you, your questions and your stories at 800-642-1234. Have you been through rehab? Have you done it yourself for alcohol or drug addiction or someone in your family? Did it work? What was the result? Do you work in this industry? Are you a healthcare provider? How do you see these issues being dealt with? Are our treatments out there effective or not? 800-642-1234 or send us an email at talk@wpr.org. Ann Fletcher, one thing that struck me about your book is there shouldn't be, I think you're making the case, there shouldn't be a one-size-fits-all approach. What works for me might not work for you.
Yes. Well, I mentioned earlier that there were three main findings. If I had to step back and say what are, because one of the things that I did was, I guess if you said, you know, what was your book about? It was really studying the addiction treatment system, the strengths and weaknesses. And there are a lot of problems in our addiction treatment system. And part of what spurred my writing this book was after I wrote, this is my second book on addiction. My first book came out in 2001, and it's called Sober for Good. And it's about the many paths to recovery in people who had recovered from serious alcohol problems. They had at least 5 years of sobriety. So I've had an interest in this for a long time, partly spurred by my own struggles with alcohol. But for that book, I interviewed more than 200 people who had been sober for at least 5 years. And I'm going to come back to your one-size-fits-all. But just to give a little background, in the course of writing that book, I got to know one of the leading experts in the country who studied addiction treatment programs. His name is Dr. Tom McClellan. He wrote the addiction for the new book, Inside Rehab. And he started telling me about the deplorable state of addiction treatment in this country. And he's been studying it for many years. And he would tell me things like the turnover of staff in addiction treatment programs is as high as that in fast food restaurants. And I said, you've got to be kidding me. Well, that's really bad for patients, especially patients with such serious problems. Not only is addiction a serious problem, but the co-occurring psychiatric problems that people have. You can't have people who are coming and going all the time. He said, you know, most of them are not using scientific approaches. Most of them don't have advanced degrees. Most of these programs don't have psychologists and psychiatrists and social workers on staff. So that was part of what piqued my interest years ago to start looking at this. And then there was so much interest with celebrities going out in and out of rehab. And so about 5 years ago, that's when I really thought, well, I'm going to go inside rehab. But my three key findings, if you ask me to really step back and say, what are the major issues in the industry at the end of 5 years of studying this, are one-size-fits-all treatment, and if there were more options, more people would be helped. And we'll come, that's the first question you were just asking me about now. The other big issue, and we can come back to this too, is that there's a huge gap between what science shows to be effective and what actually goes on in most treatment programs across the country. And the third is the things that we think should protect us, the things that are in place, such as licensing and credentialing in this field, really don't, because they don't, or they are not the kinds of protections that we think they are. So, you want to go back to your one-size-fits-all?
Yeah, let's hit that one-size-fits-all. And one thing that struck me as heartbreaking about your book is you talk to some people, they relapsed or whatever terminology people want to use, went back to the program, and the message seems to be consistently, it's not the problem's fault, it's your fault. You know, the program didn't fail you, you failed the program.
You failed the program, right. And that happened over and over again. And there tend, you know, people even use these words, they're cookie-cutter approaches. One woman who went to a very expensive, very famous program said to me, I looked around at night, and we were all doing the same homework. And these programs always talk about how they individualize treatment. But there's this notion, it's a very old-fashioned notion, that all addicts are the same. This is one of the most complex disorders that there is. All addicts are not the same any more than all people with diabetes or hypertension are the same. If they truly believe that addiction is a disease, which most people see it as these days, especially a serious substance problem, then why would we use the same approach to treat everybody? Typically what happens is everybody is put into group, as Dr. McClellan said earlier, or said one of my favorite quotes is, if you go to just about any addiction treatment program in this country, one thing he said is, they're all the same. If you just go to one, you've seen them all. It's a bit of an exaggeration, but he said the major treatment activity in just about any program is going to be group. And if that doesn't work, then they'll try group. And if all else fails, they'll try group again. Group treatment doesn't work for a lot of people. And many people told, you think about the intimate problems that many people struggle with addiction. A lot of them are ashamed of the things that they did when they were under the influence. One woman said to me, I couldn't share some of those things in front of a group, and I wasn't able to get well until I went to a program where I had more individual therapy. And I do profile programs and visited some that offer unique individual treatment with people with advanced degrees. One of the things that floored me that I wasn't expecting to find was that at some of these programs where you're paying at least $30,000 a month, I was able to follow people through their schedules for an entire day. And the typical day, at some of the programs I visited, these expensive, high-end, traditional kind of 12-step-based programs, you are in some kind of group activity, not including meals, for about 8 hours a day. You are only getting 3 to 5 hours of individual work, counseling, a week. And that's if you have a co-occurring psych problem, you're only seeing a doctoral level person about 1 hour a week. Now, if I sent my kid, I have three adult, young adult kids, if I sent one of my kids to a place like this, I would think they'd get more than an hour a week with a doctoral level person. Any individual time you get is usually with a bachelor's level, maybe a master's level addiction counselor. We'll come back to their credentials in a minute. AA is in at least 7 to 8 out of every 10 programs in the country in some shape or form. It's great when it works, but we know that up to 80% of people encouraged to attend AA while in treatment will stop attending in less than a year, and they're almost never told about any other options. And there are other options for support. Smart Recovery, Women for Sobriety, encourage people to go to church groups, but they're often told AA is the only way, and if you don't connect with it, you're doomed to failure. And it's very depressing for people, and as you said in the beginning, kind of the message is, well, you failed the program, and then you go back, and the same thing happens all over again.
That's Ann Fletcher. She's author of the new book, Inside Rehab, The Surprising Truth About Addiction Treatment and How to Get Help That Works. She's been a health and science writer for a long time, tracking issues of addiction in this and other books. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send us an email, talk@WPR.org. Maybe share your own experience inside rehab or getting some kind of outpatient addiction rehab therapy, or as a healthcare provider. I'm Rob Ferret, filling in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Rob Ferret, filling in for Joy Cardine here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow is the State of the Tribes address in Wisconsin. Tomorrow at 1 o'clock, you can hear that streaming online at WPR.org. Gordon Thayer, the LaCorte Couturier chairman, delivers that address. Check it out live, WPR.org. Right now, we're talking about addiction treatment, drug and alcohol addiction treatment, with the author of Inside Rehab, The Surprising Truth About Addiction Treatment and How to Get Help That Works. Ann Fletcher is a longtime health writer. I've been tracking these issues for quite a while. She visited at least 15 different treatment facilities, talked to over 100 clients and a bunch of people who work or have worked in these things, expert in the field, trying to figure out what works, what doesn't, what's wrong with the system, what needs to be done to fix it? We'll get to your calls in just a moment at 800-642-1234. Ann Fletcher, before the break, you mentioned the qualifications of people working in these rehabilitation programs. How do they fall short?
Well, I guess if I had to pick the one thing that really surprised me, and this came from a huge report from a group called CASA Columbia, C-A-S-A, it's an acronym. They're kind of a think tank group in New York that issued a huge report on the state of addiction treatment right before my book was going to press. And they studied the credentialing, what it takes to become an addiction counselor in all the states in the country. And they found that more than half of states in this country do not require a minimum of a bachelor's degree to become an addiction counselor. The lion's share of treatment in these programs is provided by addiction counselors. So you're not even having people with a minimum of a bachelor's degree completing this incredibly complex disorder. The experts I interviewed said that you should have at least a master's degree, as you do in any other kind of treating any other kind of mental health disorder, to treat addiction. There's only one state that required a master's degree. Don't ask me what it was. I don't remember. But I do have a whole section that talks about guidelines for finding a qualified addiction expert. Many of our physicians and psychologists are not adequately trained in this area either, and certainly not physicians. But again, they're guidelines for finding somebody who is.
And that leads to another point you touched on earlier. The treatments being offered are not always science-based.
That's right. Most addiction treatment programs say they're using scientifically backed approaches, and they are to some extent, but most are used minimally and not as they're meant to be used in research studies. And this has actually been measured by experts who go into programs. One expert, Kathleen Carroll from Yale University, has done this, and she said a lot of what goes on is chat, checking in with clients, winging it. An example would be a lot of what goes on, and I observe this, is educational lectures and films. A lot of that, the this is your brain on drugs stuff. Addicts and alcoholics know the damage that this does to their system. There's a lot of education about AA. Hundreds of studies show these approaches to be among the least effective ways to treat alcohol problems, but they still go on. Another example would be failure to use medications that we know help people with cravings, particularly when they leave the program. Only about 2 out of 10 programs nationwide use FDA-approved medications for alcohol problems, and a lot of places don't use medications that help people with the cravings that lead them back to using prescription painkillers and heroin.
Why not?
Well, it's kind of this old-fashioned thinking that you don't use drugs to treat a drug addict, an alcoholic. It's very old-fashioned thinking. I mean, some people just think you're not really in recovery if you're still on a medication. But again, it's kind of a very inconsistent with the notion that this is a disease. If it's a disease, why would you not use a medication that helps people? It just doesn't make a lot of sense.
Right. You wouldn't say to somebody with a bacterial infection, well, just, you know, use your willpower to get over that. We're not going to bother with the drugs.
That's right. And there are many, many studies, dozens, that show that people with an opioid addiction, so that would be addiction to prescription painkillers and heroin, and believe it or not, lots of kids like who get addicted to prescription painkillers will go over to heroin. They're finding this now because it's cheaper and easier to get. So they might get hooked on their parents' meds, you know, that they find left over, and then they'll go over to heroin because of the accessibility. To get people off these medications, they seem to have a powerful hold on the brain that draws them back to using again. Methadone and Suboxone, which is a newer kind of, acts kind of like methadone. These are drugs that prevent the cravings that lead people back to using these drugs. They're often used just to detox people in rehab. If they're not used beyond that, if the patient is not sent home on them and they're used on a long-term basis, I've known people who are on these medications for years, and they don't make you high if they're used appropriately. They keep you normal. If people are not kept on these meds for a period of time, the research shows that they are much more likely to relapse and even die. And I found very famous programs that refuse to use these meds.
That's Ann Fletcher talking about her new book, Inside Rehab. We'll go to the phones now. We've got a lot of listeners on the line with questions and stories to share. Mark in Milwaukee, you're on the line. Hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I certainly appreciate any literary work on the subject, but from my personal experience, and that's all I can share, I am a recovering addict. I recently celebrated 28 years clean and sober.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And I don't take a lot of credit for that. But I got clean and sober back in the heyday of treatment with the benefit of a 28-day inpatient treatment program. I went to a halfway house, a three-quarter way house. I continued outpatient care and attend several 12-step fellowships on a regular basis to this day. And I certainly understand, you know, since insurance has changed over the years and, you know, group therapy, I understand, can consist of 25 to 30 people, and someone who needs to share and is looking to share, maybe given the opportunity to talk once every week or two, maybe treatment programs being cut to 14 days or less. But all I can say from my own experience is I would probably not be alive today, much less clean and sober, were it not for a 28-day inpatient treatment program, a halfway house, a three-quarter way house, and trained professionals, as well as the rest of the treatment team that did include a counselor trainee who probably didn't have an advanced degree, but medical doctor, psychiatrist, psychologist, treatment professional with an advanced degree. And that's what worked for me. And I don't believe, if you took away much of any of that, that it would have been successful.
Thanks a lot for sharing your story, Mark. And it sounds like the key to that is something that you talk about some in your book. Mark didn't go to the 28-day rehab program and then done. He had all that follow-up. How important is that?
Absolutely. There's a whole chapter that deals with what happens after treatment. And he illustrates beautifully the, well, first of all, it sounds like it was a whole team approach with multiple professionals involved. And the and also, you know, there's an element of readiness. You know, is the person really ready? And some people can go through that whole spectrum that he described multiple times, and it's important to understand that it often takes more than once, and he's fortunate that it didn't wasn't necessary in his case. So, you know, you don't know the circumstances of any one person. But the important take-home message from all of that, I think, was the continuity and long-term care. NIDA, the National Institute on Drug Abuse, says that treatment for somebody with a severe addiction should be a minimum of 90 days. So, and every treatment program I went to really recognized that. Now, that doesn't mean you're in a treatment program for 90 days, you know, 24 hours a day. But the current recognition is that this is a chronic illness for somebody with a severe addiction that waxes and wanes. You go in and out of the problem, and you should have perhaps somebody that could be an individual therapist with expertise in addictions for your entire life that you can touch base with and go back to if you feel you're at risk for relapse. But that model of going to treatment, and then they call it stepping down to a less intense level of care, so that he went to less intensive levels of care along the way and was kind of weaned off treatment, and then getting involved in what sounds like may have been a 12-step program. And there's great support in any kind of self-help group, and we know that that helps a lot of people. The important thing is that people are given options and choices.
Mark, thank you so much for calling, and I'm glad you're clean, sober, and alive. We'll go now to Chris in Spooner. Hi, Chris.
How are you doing this morning?
I'm good. How are you?
Real well. I'm a 62-year-old hippie that started using whatever in about 1963. Got straight and sober for about 15 years at the age of 28. The age of 44, my wife left me and my kids. We've been married 23 years, and rather than hit my knees and pray for more strength, I started getting high again. And my drug of choice at that point was methamphetamine. And I was able to use it for free because a friend of mine was in a motorcycle club and he wanted me to hang with him. So for 1 year, I was high, whiskey, women, everything that goes with addiction. Christmas came. My grown daughters met with me at my parents'. It was uneasy. They came to my house. They left. One came back in and said, Dad, we're afraid you're going to die. Would you please stop doing, we don't know what you're doing, but would you please stop? I went in, looked in the mirror, didn't like what I saw, fell to my knees, asked the Lord Jesus for help, and I felt like a spirit lifted out of me, an evil spirit. And I've been straight and sober since then, and it's a work. I never went to treatment, had no counseling, but I did make a conscious effort to get away from what I was doing, and I felt strengthened through Christ Jesus. And I know lots of people that have tried Hazelden. They've tried all the best, this and that. And to a person, they got better help at a place, and I'm not pimping this place, but it really works. It's called Teen Challenge. It's faith-based. And I know the recidivism rate for methamphetamine especially, it's 70% if you go to a normal counseling place.
Chris, I want to bring our guest in on this, but thanks for sharing your story, and good luck to you on staying off of meth and the alcohol. Ann Fletcher, you talked about people like Chris earlier who did it through spirituality, through religion, without going into a rehab program.
Yeah, that's a powerful story. Well, first of all, it illustrates that people can relapse after many years of sobriety. They think that there are changes. We know are learning a lot now about the brain and changes that occur that may, some of which may be permanent, that show how easy it is to go back to a drug or drugs, especially if there are situations like the stress of a marriage ending. And it shows that it's an illness or whatever you want to call it. I don't argue with people about whether it's a disease or not, but there is a biological basis for this, and it's important for people to understand this. And some drugs draw us back more easily than others. Meth and opioids seem to be more powerful than others, but alcohol, I mean, any drug can have that powerful hold and change on the brain. But yes, this ability of people to change, and for him it was religion. I did, and there are faith-based programs that are not 12-step based. I did visit one in California, and I believe they incorporated the 12 steps as well. But there are many, many different ways to do this. And I did hear about Teen Challenge. For some people, find that to be a very coercive program, but there are some people for whom it works. The important thing is for people not to be forced. We know that people do better when they have choice and say. And again, one of the old approaches with addiction was confrontation. We build you down, and I mean, we tear you down, and then we build you back up again. And that has been shown in many studies, confrontation, to be one of the least effective approaches. It backs people into a corner. It's what makes people lie. People often say, all addicts lie. Well, the research shows that people are honest if they don't feel that they have a reason to lie. Of course people lie if you're backing them into a corner like a little child. Did you eat that chocolate cookie with the chocolate all over their face? Well, of course they're going to lie. But if you work with people, it's called one of the evidence-based approaches that works very well with people with addiction. It's called motivational interviewing. And it's a much more gentle, more Carl Rogers kind of approach, if for people who are familiar with that. But that's the closest analogy I can make. But it invites people to change and doesn't shove things down people's throat. And the research shows that people who are given choices are more likely to change and involved in their treatment as opposed to being told what to do.
Thanks for the call, Chris. We had a caller on the line, Devin, who was wondering, are there programs out there? He thinks there aren't enough programs out there for people between 18 and 24. And that's something you get into your book for teens, younger adults. What works for them is different than what might work for older people.
Yes. Well, and the sad thing is we know that that's true, what you just said. What works for teens is different. Or we shouldn't be putting teens in adult programs. And unfortunately, most of what's offered to teens are programs that are just adapted from adult programs. And there aren't many programs out there that are specifically for teens. There just hasn't been much research. But I profile a number of evidence-based, science-based approaches that were not available at any of the programs I visited. They were all basically 12-step-based programs that have not been really tested for teens. And that's pretty much what you find around the country, not the science-based programs that I found, that I researched and came across. There's a program called ACRA. That's an acronym. I forget what it stands for, but if you look up A-CRA, and it's fully described in the book, and there are two others that have been shown in scientific studies to be far more effective for teens. They really involve the family, and that's so important for teenagers. There are evidence-based approaches for teens, but they're being used in very few programs across the country. I tell people how to find the programs that work. But specifically for that age group, the in-betweens, like 18 to 22, I think we're going to see a growing number of programs address that age group because they don't really belong in with teens and they don't really belong in with adults. One program I visited, Caron, C-A-R-O-N, on the East Coast. Now, they're a very traditional 12-step-based program, but they told me that they have seen a significant decrease in their dropout rates since they have a program for young women and young men. And there are other programs across the country who are addressing the specific needs of this age group, which has a very, very high substance use disorder rate.
Talking to Ann Fletcher about her new book, Inside Rehab, The Surprising Truth About Addiction Treatment and How to Get Help That Works. Coming up in just a few moments, I'll ask her how to get help that works, some advice for people who might be considering going into treatment. Still time for your calls at 800-642-1234. I'm Rob Ferret, filling in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Rob Ferret filling in for Joy Cardine here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow at this time, it's this week's edition of On Your Money with financial planner Kevin McKinley. Right now I'm talking to Ann Fletcher about her book, Inside Rehab, The Surprising Truth About Addiction Treatment and How to Get Help That Works. We'll get to more of your calls in just a moment. But first, Ann, suppose somebody out there is listening right now and says, I have an addiction problem. I know I have an addiction problem. I want to get treatment. Where do they start? How do they get rolling?
Well, I'm not going to go through them all, but there's a long consumer checklist for checking out rehabs in the appendix of the book. Each chapter has questions and checklists for the particular problem. So if you have a co-occurring psych problem, how do you find a good quality program? Because many programs say they treat those problems, but they don't really do it. And that's coming from experts in the field, not just from me. So how do you ask the right questions? But looking at a few tips. My first bit of advice, if you have somebody in your life or you have a serious drug or alcohol problem, your first, your knee-jerk reaction should not be, I need to go to rehab. unless it's a very serious problem where the person might need medically supervised withdrawal or detox, my first consideration would be to find somebody in your community, an individual therapist or psychiatrist who has, and this is a big if, you really need to find somebody who has expertise with addictions. As I said earlier, many psychologists, psychiatrists, medical doctors are not adequately trained in addiction, but there are some who are. I give guidelines for how to find them, but part of it is sitting down with the Yellow Pages, and a lot of people will list themselves as having expertise in that area, but ask them, what's your training? How did you get trained? But I can think of, I live in a university town of about 50,000 in what they call outstate Minnesota, and I can think of several master's and doctoral level psychologists, or you could find an addiction psychiatrist, who will see you one-on-one, do an assessment. A person like that doesn't have a vested interest financially in admitting you into their treatment program, which is, I talk about that issue in my book. See them for an assessment about whether outpatient residential treatment are really warranted, and maybe that person could even see you individually. Maybe treatment isn't necessary at all. As Dr. Willenbring, a famous addiction psychiatrist, said in my book, you are the customer. Ask questions and educate yourself the way you would if you were having surgery or cancer treatment. Sometimes there isn't time because the law is holding a stick over your head and you have to get somebody in fast. Don't accept anything less than a master's degree prepared therapist or counselor as the person who's going to be the primary care provider, so ask that. of any program you're going to. Who will be providing the bulk of my care? If you don't like the therapist or counselor at the place you go to, ask if you will be able to switch, or ask that question up front. If I don't care for the person, will I be able to switch? They'll often blame it on the patient. Oh, well, he's just resisting treatment. You need to like the person you're seeing or the treatment won't be effective. Is it a place that routinely uses medications that have been shown to be effective for addiction? If they tell you they don't, then they are not using current science. So those are just some of the things to look for. Oh, another thing is, don't pay for residential or inpatient treatment thinking that the outcomes are better, because research suggests that outpatient treatment, which is less expensive, is just as effective overall as residential treatment. And I have guidelines for who really needs to go to residential treatment, and it's really the minority of people who have failed at outpatient treatment over and over again, who have very severe addiction, who have very severe co-occurring psych problems.
We'll go back to the phones now. We have John with us in La Crosse. Hi, John.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me.
What's on your mind?
Well, Ann has hit on a lot of strong points. I'm 20 years old. I have a 3.9 GPA, and I'm a pre-veterinary student, and I'm actually driving to my court date right now. And I'm just, you know, a step away from becoming a felon. I just want to kind of speak on my experience of, drug abuse and mental health, you know, throughout the years. What I want to say is, you spoke earlier that, you know, drug abuse is, you know, related to 50%, you know, mental health. I would say it's much, much higher. Every NA and AA meeting I've gone to, I've got to say almost every story is the same, and almost everyone I know is struggling, you know, who is struggling with drug or alcohol abuse has a mental health issue. I would say it's closer to 75%, 80%, maybe even higher. And with that said, you know, you also stated earlier there's 13,000 programs, and, you know, I have every resource in the world. I have a family that loves me. I have, you know, a monetary support system. I'm in college, and I have no idea where to get help. I don't know if it's the lack of education or, you know, what it is, but how is someone with no resources, no money, with an addiction supposed to get help like that? It's just, I'm frustrated, I guess, you know, and as far as inadequate counselors, you couldn't be more correct on that. I would say I have not shown up to so many of my different programs because the counselor has just been absolutely unintelligent or not helpful or caring, you know?
Gotcha. Thanks a lot for the call, John, and good luck to you, first of all. And John's not alone in the story he's telling, is he?
Yeah, and I really feel for him, and I'm not trying to sell him a book, but that's my book was written for people like this, and it's just not just written for people who have the resources to go to a high-end rehab. It really helps people at all ends of the spectrum. You can get it from a library, you know, if you can't afford to buy a book. It really would be tremendously helpful. I would say that in response to his comment about the and the other thing is that this is really important. I found that some of the best programs were for people who didn't have resources, because publicly funded programs often are funded by grants, and grants require often a master's degree professional. The question is finding a good one. And there were some in your state that I found that were quite good. I can't name, well, I did, actually, this one was for women. The ARC program, I believe, was in Wisconsin, ARC, that's another acronym. But there are some very good publicly funded programs. Sometimes people who work with people in the courts do know what the better programs are. So if you can get a good advocate who works with you or a good social worker, they can guide you. And you do have a say sometimes in where you go for treatment. And I did interview people like him who talked about how you can advocate for yourself. But anyway, some of those programs actually offer better treatment than some of the fancy programs because of the government grant funding that requires higher caliber addiction counselors and evidence-based treatment approaches to be used. So I was very, and more comprehensive approaches that don't just address the addiction. They address rehabilitating people, dealing with the psychiatric problems. And when one important point that his comment raised when he said, well, there's more than half of people have a co-occurring problem. People who go to addiction treatment programs and who go to 12-step meetings are at the more severe end of the addiction disorder spectrum. So they are more likely to have co-occurring psychiatric problems. So the prevalence is probably higher than 50%. But what we need to realize is that, particularly with alcohol problems, the people who go to treatment are people with severe substance use disorders. There is a whole other group of people, far greater numbers of people, with mild to moderate substance use disorders, particularly alcohol problems, and I talk about this in the book, who are functioning in their daily lives, who are not getting sent to court, who are sitting next to you at church, who are sitting next to you at work. You probably don't know they have problems, but they're suffering from depression. It's, you know, they're falling asleep, and, you know, and their wives are mad at them because they drink too much. They're not getting help because they don't really belong in AA meetings. They don't belong in treatment programs. And I talk a lot about the kind of help that they need. And we don't have treatment programs designed to help people like this. They often would do well with an individual therapist, but they don't know because they think the only treatment that's out there is treatment programs and AA. And we need to get the message out that help is available for people like this, too.
Thanks for the call, John. Kim is with us in Milwaukee. Hi, Kim.
Oh, hi. I was calling because I have a couple of friends who were looking into getting into programs to help them with alcoholism. However, they're not people of faith. And from what they've told me, Alcoholics Anonymous is a program for people who are of faith. And I was wondering if there are other resources for them.
Well, there are people who do well in AA who are, you know, that are not religious. There's some people who are able to get around that part of AA. But some alternatives would be Smart Recovery. And I believe there are Smart Recovery groups in your area. So it stands for Self-Management and Recovery Training. Smart Recovery has about 800 groups nationwide. It has no spiritual or religious component. It is based on scientific principles of cognitive behavioral therapy. It has a strong online presence. Another group that is specifically geared for women is Women for Sobriety. They have a very strong, if you can't find a group in your area, they have a very strong online presence as well. Another alternative, all of these are described in the book too, if you want more information, but you can find them online, Secular Organizations for Sobriety. So and if you enter non-12-step treatment into a Google search or any kind of a search, you will find alternatives.
Thanks a lot for the call, Kim. We have just a minute left, and in a lot of ways, we've just scratched the surface of what you write about, Ann. In less than a minute, if a policymaker at the state or federal level, you said, Ann, we've got the support, we can make one change to our laws about rehabilitation programs in this country or funding, what one change would you tell them to make right now?
Oh, boy, that's a tough question. Believe it or not, nobody has asked me that in all the interviews I've done. I don't know that I could pick one. We need more funding for research. We need more funding. There's far more money that goes into the study and treatment of most other disorders. And this problem, particularly alcohol problems, wreaks so much havoc in our society and our lives. And I don't have the figures in front of me. They're in the book. But the percentage of our healthcare dollars and research dollars that are given to this problem is minuscule, and that's what we need. We need money for treatment for all ends of the spectrum, not just the severe problems, because we want to prevent those lesser problems from becoming severe, and for research for treatment.
Ann Fletcher, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Ann Fletcher, author of Inside Rehab, The Surprising Truth About Addiction Treatment and How to Get Help That Works. We'll have a link to her website, I think her blog, on our program notes and at the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Thanks to Cynthia Schuster for producing this hour. She also gave us on-air direction. Bill Martins answered your phone calls. I'm Rob Ferret, filling in for Joy Cardine here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.